I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, the Supreme Court closes its term with key decisions on race-based school admissions and the death penalty. But first, senators have killed the president's landmark immigration legislation. The bill's bipartisan supporters fell 14 votes short of keeping the measure alive today. That bill would have provided a pathway to citizenship for the country's 12 million undocumented immigrants if they passed background checks and paid fees and fines. The bill also called for tougher border enforcement, but it wasn't enough to convince many Republicans and some Democrats to allow the bill to move forward. Well, joining us from a busy Washington, Gail Chadwick, senior congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, what was it like out there on the floor of the Senate today?
Very intense. The phone lines had shut down this morning with calls from angry constituents. You had two cabinet secretaries at the front door of the Senate as senators moved purposefully through the door. In some cases, they were double-teaming these senators to try to eke out a few last-minute votes. You know, we heard last night that it was very likely not to pass, but no one that I know expected it to fail by not to get even a majority. This was 46-51 with 37 Republicans, 15 Democrats, and independent Bernie Sanders of Vermont voting against it.
Well, what do you think happened? You mentioned it was Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff who was cornering senators on the way to the floor, and we know that Republican Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina, who's been an opponent of the bill, said that the Senate phone system did crash because he got so many calls. Was it the last-minute push by conservative talk show hosts and radio? I mean, what happened in the last week?
You know, I don't believe it was so much last-minute as just the cumulative effect of a process that wasn't working very well. They couldn't get a real debate on amendments to this bill to improve it. And the issue that I heard the most about, especially from Democrats who voted against it, was enforcement. They did not believe that the government would enforce the law, and certainly their constituents didn't, no matter how attractive it was, no matter how many miles of fencing would be built. I think one of the most effective arguments that conservatives made was that much that was in this law, in terms of new enforcement, already was law, except more of it. More fences in previous law, more border guards in previous law, but the government simply wouldn't enforce it. And I think in the end, it was a very telling argument.
Well, we understand that President Bush made several phone calls to senators as well today. How big of a setback is this for him?
I think it's huge. Senator Harry Reid, the majority leader afterwards, said that, you know, we're only 6 months into the Congress. It will come back. It's only a matter of when. But the kind of general view, just talking to senators about the calendar they have, about the presidential election coming up, and again, also about how wary members on both sides of the aisle are about running into a buzzsaw from their constituents on this issue. It is very emotional. They need time to work out a lot more trust among themselves and especially with the American public than they were able to do today.
Well, what we're reading, and it seems like the thinking is that it won't even be taken up until after there's someone new in the Oval Office, if at all.
That's my understanding. I was surprised when Senator Reid said we're only 6 months into this Congress. That left the door open that he might bring it back. But I think that would be a very heavy lift at this point, given the size of this vote in opposition.
A quick question for you, Gail. What does this do to President Bush's legacy?
There's not much of it. He has education, which is coming up for reauthorization and is also going to face a very tough row. And what he wanted this term was Social Security reform, which is going nowhere, and immigration, which took a big hit today.
Gail Chadwick, senior congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, one place where President Bush can arguably say he has left his mark is the Supreme Court. And the court wrapped up its session with several decisions today, among them deciding that public schools cannot use race as a deciding factor in filling open spots in schools. The court sided with parents who'd sued schools in Louisville, Kentucky, and Seattle. This could affect, though, hundreds of other schools and leave them fewer options to obtain racial diversity. And today the court also effectively blocked the execution of a mentally ill convicted murderer in Texas. Continuing a theme from the year past, the court voted 5-4 in all the cases with Justice Kennedy the deciding vote. Today we're going to have two conversations about this conservative court. And first, the conservative view. Douglas Kimmeck worked in the Reagan Justice Department. He's professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University Law School in California. Professor Kimmeck, welcome back to Here Now.
Good morning.
And first of all, your thoughts on, in particular, the race-based decision. Some background to remind us. Quotas have long been illegal, race-based quotas, and past courts have ruled that colleges can use race as one factor. So, to today, the majority wrote that public schools went too far in using race as a factor in filling the last few spots at public magnet schools, even if their goal was to achieve diversity. Justice Kennedy commented he doesn't feel race should be eliminated completely, but he agreed with the majority that the schools went too far. So, as a conservative, how do you react to this?
Well, I think it's a very principled decision. I think the differences between Justice Kennedy and the Chief Justice are not overwhelming. Both of the justices very clearly state that the use of race solely for the purposes of balancing is inappropriate, that race is a factor that is subject to strict scrutiny, and it is subject to the requirement that there be a compelling governmental interest demonstrated, and that there was no compelling governmental interest demonstrated in this case.
Does it leave a lot of questions, though, as to exactly how race can be used?
Well, it makes it clear that race can't be used casually, and I think that's perhaps the most important instruction. Where there was a difference of opinion between the Chief Justice and Justice Kennedy was on this: how much race could be taken into consideration, not in individual decisions with respect to particular students, but with respect to the kind of macro decisions that a school district makes. For example, how to allocate resources among the schools, which academic offerings to provide, how to draw the district lines, whether you could take into account, for example, that there are still racial patterns or stratifications in housing, and that you could allocate new schools to try and break down some of those racial patterns. It's notable that the Chief Justice doesn't rule that out of bounds. He just says, that's not before us. What we have in this case was a very stark use of race, where people were classified as either black or white without any differentiation, for example, among minority groups, and that race itself was kind of the sole decision maker, and that had never been approved under the prior precedents of the court. Race is permissible under Brown versus the Board to overcome past discrimination that was enforced under law, and as you mentioned, the court approved race to be a factor in higher education for purposes of achieving diversity, but the objective there was diversity, not a particular percentage or racial balance. So I think this is a very important decision that reaffirms that the Equal Protection Clause means what it says, that no person shall be denied equal protection of the law. Equal justice under law means decisions made by public officials without regard to race. And the door is left open for a consideration of race
as one factor.
As one factor.
And we're going to be talking to Professor Jonathan Turley in a moment. We'll have his view on it as well. But I want to take a look at the past year with you. Let's start with your thoughts about the criticism among, apparently, conservative jurists that spilled over onto the front pages of the New York Times today. Justice Scalia criticizing through his writings Justices Roberts and Alito, accusing them of essentially not having the guts to say outright that they're overturning precedent. Now, the campaign finance ruling on Monday, for instance, allows these issue ads from corporations and groups to attack candidates close to elections. The same court banned those ads in 2000, and Scalia said to Robert and Alito, accusing them of false judicial modesty because they didn't, those are his words, because they didn't come out and say, we've overturned our own precedent. What, how, your feelings on this debate?
There's nothing false about the judicial modesty whatsoever. With all due respect to Justice Scalia, he may be certain in his views. He may know exactly where the trajectory of the law is going, not just in the case in front of him, but in the next 12 cases. But the Chief Justice made it plain, Justice Alito made it plain in their confirmation proceedings, that they were going to decide one case at a time. They were going to decide it on their individual facts in a judicial manner. And even if you have a clear idea of the philosophy of the law, as no one would doubt Justice Scalia has in terms of his ability to articulate it, it's simply inappropriate to reach beyond the scope of the matter that needs to be decided.
But and we should. I just rush to add that Scalia has also been criticized from the left, from people who said that both Roberts and Alito told Congress that they believed in stare decisis, that's keeping precedent, and now they're not abiding by that pledge and perhaps just don't want to say it out loud.
Well, I just don't think that's right. They are quite appropriately addressing the limits of prior precedent. For example, in the Hind case, this was the case dealing with whether or not taxpayers have special standing, which they generally don't have, in Establishment Clause cases. The case that the prior precedent, the FLAST decision, had given that a very narrow scope over a body of precedent. Justice Roberts, Justice Alito were honoring that, and they were simply not prepared to say, as Justice Scalia wanted them to say, let's throw over what we had done before.
I want to make sure we, you know, with the time we have with you, we've touched on some of the other items. And staying with some of the language of the opinions, Justice Kennedy wrote one opinion that sparked a lot of criticism. It was about the upholding of a ban on the so-called partial birth abortions. And in his writing, He said, we don't find any data to prove this, but it seems okay to conclude that, and I'm paraphrasing him for time, that women come to regret their choice to abort an infant. A lot of people, of course, Jeffrey Toobin, one of them writing in The New Yorker, say, you know, this was patronizing. It is, as Kennedy says, without any basis. Were his comments appropriate?
You know, I think these are comments that are not uncommon in Supreme Court opinions in the sense that they explain some of the concerns that the particular writer has. They don't stand for the holding of that case. The holding of that case is that Congress has the ability to rule out of bounds a particularly extreme form of an abortion practice that they carefully describe, and that in terms of the health exception needed to preserve the right, that health exception is better considered not in a macro sense, but in the context of each specific person that comes before the court. Justice Kennedy, I think, is basically saying that we have always, in the context of medical procedures, assumed that doctors are going to be fulsome in their explanation of the procedure that's involved so that the patient can make a meaningful choice. And it seems to me a meaningful choice in the context of this rather horrific procedure is an understanding of what the procedure is.
Douglas Kamek, we've got 30 seconds. Your sense of the past year. You're satisfied with it as a conservative?
I am very pleased with the past year because this has been, I think, a vindication of an effort of over several decades since the Reagan administration to have a court act as a court, to establish the rule of law, not the rule of ideology, whether it be the ideology of left or the ideology of right.
Douglas Kamek, professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And Jonathan Turley's next, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Supreme Court wrapped up its term today with a ruling limiting further the use of race in school admissions, public school admissions. And there was another decision effectively stopping Texas from executing a convicted murderer who is mentally incapable of understanding his punishment. We're joined now by Jonathan Turley, professor of public interest law at George Washington University. And Jonathan, as you know, we just spoke with Professor Kamek of Pepperdine, who said he was pleased with the court over the past year because, in part, there was no ideology of the left or the right. Your thoughts? All right.
Well, hi, Robin. I can understand why Doug is very happy about it, but I can't imagine how anyone could look at this court on either the left or right and not see ideology. Despite the pledge of Roberts to be something of a uniter, the court is more divided than ever. We've had over 16 5-4 decisions. The language used on both sides has been quite passionate, in some cases vitriolic. There is a great deal of philosophical disagreement here.
Well, I want to jump to one of the most dramatic, some would say, instances of this, and this is when Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg read her dissent on the partial birth abortion case. She said essentially the only thing different this time around from when the court last ruled, and by the way, when the court last ruled, it upheld the right to this procedure. This time around, the court upheld a ban on the so-called partial birth abortion procedure, which only it's very rarely used. She said the only thing different was the composition of the court, implying that people were just voting for their side. When she read that, though, I could hear Americans saying, but isn't that how it works? I mean, it feels that way to a lot of Americans, that you just get as many people on your side on the court as you can, and then they vote.
Well, I think that certainly is what the court has become, and there are many people that I think have good faith reasons for questioning what's called stare decisis, that is, whether the court should continue to support a doctrine that the individual justices don't agree with. And there are many people that say, look, you shouldn't do that, that if you think Roe v. Wade is wrong, then you shouldn't pretend that it's right. But this court has been ideological for some time, and I think that Ginsburg complaining about that neglects the fact, as you've noted, that it was 5-4 the other way, and there wasn't a lot of complaints going on then. But the abortion decision was very significant. I also agree when you pointed out the one line of that Justice Kennedy wrote. It said, quote, "It seems unexceptional to conclude that some women come to regret their choice to abort the infant life they once created and sustained." I was just flabbergasted to see that type of personal viewpoint come into the decision.
Well, tell me others. Were there any that jumped out and surprised you?
In terms of cases?
Excuse me?
In terms of that decision?
In terms of any of the cases. Were there any, you know, if you're saying that they were ideological and mostly predictable, I would imagine, were there any that surprised you?
Well, not necessarily surprised as much as confirm my worst expectations. I think one of the most shocking was Bowles v. Russell, which nobody has paid attention to. It's a small case involving a criminal appeal. And in this case, the defendant was told by the court, his attorney was told by the court, to file his appeal on a certain day. Well, that date that the court picked happened to be 3 days later than the date that would be set under the normal rules. Well, the defendant and his attorney, usually you go by what the court says, and so they actually filed a little earlier than that, but followed the schedule of the court. In a decision by Thomas, in a 5-4 decision, the conservatives wiped out his appeal and said, you know, we know the judge told you that date. The judge was wrong, so you're going to be denied an appeal.
This is the case in which, in his dissents, Justice David Souter wrote, it is intolerable for the judicial system to treat people this way. There's not even a technical justification for condoning this.
And he said it correctly, it's a bait and switch, that essentially what happened is the courts entirely disenfranchised this man, entirely ruined him. And what really took me aback from that case is the lack of any compassion, any logic that would go into that decision. It's justices who are ignoring that part of their role is to do justice, that it's not just to be these sort of accountants and look at calendars. But in my view, the Bowles decision, even though it's not a huge decision, was the most vicious decision I have seen come out of that court, perhaps since the Scott decision. It's really vicious.
And how did the court justify it? I mean, one would ask, where's the compassionate conservatism? How did the court justify it?
Oh, Thomas just gave absolutely no concern at all. He just pointed out that the rule said one thing, and it was really extraordinary. I'll tell you the other stuff that was not surprising to me, but was sort of fulfilling of my worst case scenario, would include the standing case involving the Establishment Clause, the Hine versus Freedom from Religion. And in that case, they overturned, actually, Richard Posner from the Seventh Circuit, who's a conservative icon. And it involved whether taxpayers could even get into court to challenge a violation of the Establishment Clause.
And this is the faith-based, the federal money for faith-based charities, and they were challenging the government giving monies to these faith-based charities.
That's right. And what the conservative Seventh panel said was, look, we don't see any difference whether it's a violation of the Establishment Clause by the executive branch or by the legislative branch. We don't see any distinction there. And but more importantly, Posner said, look, and this is a very conservative guy, he said, if we don't accept standing, nobody could challenge this. The government in this case would be without any check or balance within the judiciary branch. Well, the court, once again, 5-4, said no. No one can challenge what the president is doing, even if it involves, now get this, even if it involves the establishment of a religion. That's what we're talking about.
Jonathan Turley, professor of public interest law at George Washington University. We've got about a minute. And just looking ahead, what do you see as this is really going to give you just a few seconds to say, what do you see showing up on the docket? We're wondering if some of the challenges of executive privilege that we're hearing about yesterday and today, subpoenas for documents from the White House and Dick Cheney's office, those challenges are going to make their way to the Supreme Court.
Well, I think they probably will. But I think, frankly, what Fred Fielding, the White House counsel, is counting on is not the Constitution, but the calendar. I think that he's planning to run this out till there's a new president and a new Congress. I think where you will see a lot of new cases is after the discrimination case today, when they ruled out race as a factor, there are a myriad of different race factors considered in elementary and high school.
And we'll have you back when those are raised. Jonathan, thank you. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There was another symbolic step this week along the long road to peace in Northern Ireland. The final British troops pulled out on Monday, ending a 37-year mission to keep watch over the Irish Republican Army. The IRA was the Catholic paramilitary group that battled the British and Protestant military groups during the bloody time known as the Troubles. Today, though, the battles are mainly political, because in May, a coalition of Protestant and Catholic leaders was formed to govern Northern Ireland. Well, one of those leaders is Nigel Dodds, the new government's top economic minister. Dodds is a member of the Democratic Unionist Party, the Protestant party that supported the British against the IRA. He's in the U.S. to remind Americans that Northern Ireland is peaceful and open for business. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
How's it going?
I think it's going very well. We've got off to a good start, and it's a great opportunity for Northern Ireland politicians to concentrate on the economy and social and economic issues for the good of all of our people rather than spending our time fighting over constitutional issues. We believe from our perspective that these constitutional matters are now settled. Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom and will remain so. So the job now is to try and get on with improving our economy, our health system, our education and our environment.
What's your pitch?
Well, our pitch is that Northern Ireland is a small place. It's flexible. We have a fantastic pool of young, talented people with all the requisite skills that are needed in the key areas of financial services, business services and IT. And that if you come to Northern Ireland, you'll find a place which has a tremendous infrastructure, 100% broadband availability, the first in the United Kingdom, tremendous transport links, and a very, very vibrant place to live. And now that we have political stability, people need have no fears about security or anything like this, and they can benefit being part of the European Union without the tariffs and all the rest of it, close to London, close to Dublin, but in a place where it has a low operating environment in terms of cost to do business.
It's been a little over a month now since your boss, who's the Reverend Ian Paisley, took over as leader of the power-sharing government in Northern Ireland. A couple thoughts, especially as you come to a city like Boston with a very large Irish Catholic population. Do you feel that your side, if you will, has sort of a PR problem in the U.S. as well, that Ian Paisley's party was seen as sort of the oppressors? It's a very simplified look at the conflict, but there are some people who might feel that way, especially in cities like Boston.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that. I've been to Boston before, and I've been to the East Coast and other parts of the States, and I'm aware of that view. It's based largely on ignorance of the facts of the matter, because, of course, the majority of the population in Northern Ireland are unionists, and indeed a recent survey showed that a quarter of all Catholics living in Northern Ireland want to remain part of the United Kingdom as well. The true oppressors were the terrorists in the IRA and other terrorists who wanted to impose their will against the majority view of the people of Northern Ireland. They wanted to impose that by terror and violence. Now, as we know, the war on terror globally is one that deserves support and deserves to be seen through to a successful end. And I'm glad that in Northern Ireland, terrorism has been defeated. The key issue, I think, is to ensure that all of us now work together for the good of all of our people, whether it be Catholic, Protestant, Unionist or Nationalist.
How do these conversations go with people that you're now, you know, working with? And maybe you avoid the conversation, but there was violence, you know, on both sides. Mm. So do you go off and have a beer and talk about it, or is it too hard?
I think it's going to be difficult. I mean, remember Sinn Féin, I mean, they're the only party in government that had a paramilitary wing which caused violence. The other parties, whether they be nationalist or unionist, did not. So it's up to them to win over people, as it were, that this has truly gone forever. I believe that they've made enormous strides. They now support the police, which they fought and targeted for many, many years. I think that's a very welcome development. They've now got to demonstrate in action that that is truly the case. But in my view, it's a matter of getting on with doing the business for the people of Northern Ireland. And, you know, you don't have to like people or even agree with them politically to be in a coalition. What you have to do is to ensure that you make your best efforts for the people.
What has to come from your side? I mean, remember Ian Paisley, for instance, calling the Roman, the Catholic Church and the Pope in Rome, the whore of Babylon. Mm. What needs to come from...
Well, I don't really want to get into a theological argument, because I think he was speaking there as a Reformed theologian. And if you look at the articles of the Church of England, the established church in the United Kingdom, and you look at the tradition of the Reformed Protestant faith, that's the sort of language that is used.
Really gives you a bad PR problem.
Well, what I would say is that there is no equivalence between, on the one hand, terrorists who use murder and violence and intimidation, which Sinn Féin did, and those of us on the Unionist side who were the targets of that, but who argued against the use of terrorism by our side.
But there certainly was violence from the side. So isn't there something that can be said
those
that
who
might
engaged,
help?
Yes, and I think that those who engaged in that violence on the Loyalist side, these are paramilitary groups like the UDA and UVF, and they're political spokespeople in their small splinter parties, but they hardly get any votes, thankfully, because most Protestants wouldn't vote for that sort of party. They need to apologise for their actions. It is not legitimate to ask those of us who opposed that and who were vilified by these small Unionist parties and their terrorist organisations for so doing to say that we should apologise, because we did oppose all of that. We opposed it tooth and nail, and we told Protestant people that they shouldn't support it in any shape or form by their votes or otherwise. But I'm glad now that we've reached a situation where hopefully across the board we can now move forward with everybody agreeing that violence is a thing of the past, terrorism is a thing of the past, and we can look forward to a more positive future.
And do you think that's going to happen?
I think it is going to happen, because I think now people realise in the post September the 11th world that terrorism is not only futile, but it's an abhorrence. It doesn't do anything positive. It's counterproductive. And it only hurts the innocent.
You know, one of the reasons I think this is so much on my mind is, of course, you know, the U.S. is now in a conflict in Iraq, looking at sectarian divisions there. And people have looked at Northern Ireland to see, well, maybe there's something there that we could see into the future, hopefully not 37 years into the future. But you were the target of Irish Republican Army attacks. A bomb was defused outside your office in North Belfast in 2003. In 1997... you survived an IRA attempt on your life when you were visiting your son in the hospital. And now you're face-to-face, I would imagine, working with people who were on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, it's personally very, very difficult. I mean, and remember, as yet, the people who carried out these attacks and who are politically represented by Sinn Féin have yet to express remorse, regret or an apology for any of it. I mean, I think it would make things a lot easier if that was addressed very, very speedily by Sinn Féin leaders and they were to acknowledge the pain that they have caused and to apologise for it, as others have done. But I've got to come to the position where, despite personal differences, that we try and do our best for the people of Northern Ireland. And my view, in my role as the economy minister, I believe I can do that very, very successfully.
Nigel Dodds, Northern Ireland's economic minister in the U.S. to promote Northern Ireland as a business opportunity. And now that the power-sharing government is in place there, thanks so much for speaking with us.
With our pleasure. Thank you.
Before we go today, an idea for all those scraps of summer you're about to collect, seashells, photographs. Artist Joseph Cornell put his memories in a box. We'll remember his work. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm told there's only one question being asked in Portland, Oregon today. Will it be Greg or Kevin? The Portland Trailblazers must choose between former Ohio State center Greg Oden and Texas swingman Kevin Durant in tonight's National Basketball Association draft. Portland gets the first pick. Here to size up that story and review the West of the Week in sports. Did I say West of the Week in sports?
We can go West if you like. It's Western Conference is better anyway.
Here now, sports guy and host of NPR's Only a Game, Bill Littlefield. We are going West. Hi, Bill.
Good to see you, Robin.
Because the last time the Portland Trailblazers had this top pick in the NBA draft, they chose Sam Bowie over Michael Jordan. Is it Bowie or Bowie?
Well, it's Bowie, but...
Did I ever even see him?
Probably not. No, you know, he had a long career, but it was a career that was plagued by an awful lot of injuries, as they say. And
he wasn't Michael Jordan.
Quite Michael Jordan.
Yeah,
right.
There you go. Well, but see, now they're picking between Oden and Durant, so can they go wrong?
They can't really go wrong. Two great players. But if Portland doesn't pick Greg Oden, an awful lot of experts are going to look as if they aren't experts after all, because everybody's saying Greg Oden will be the first pick and Kevin Durant will be the second. But the answer to your question, the short answer is no. I mean, they're both great players, and each one has the potential to be an enormously useful addition to the team that they join. And unfortunately, there's no guarantees. Sometimes you pick a guy who looks great and something awful happens.
And you mentioned injuries. So along with the draft, it's also trade time for the NBA. The other suspense is whether a number of big-name players could wind up with new addresses. My nephew is particularly concerned about Kobe Bryant. Where is Kobe Bryant going?
Well, Kobe Bryant has made an awful lot of noise in the past about not wanting to play for a team that wasn't dedicating itself to winning, and then he couldn't get along with Shaquille O'Neal.
He's with the L.A. Lakers, of course.
He's with the Lakers. My guess is that he won't be going anywhere, but you never know. One of my acquaintances, who's much more knowledgeable about the NBA than I am, assures me that some general manager will panic tonight and make a trade before he gets to make a draft pick. And so, I mean, to see panic is perhaps the greatest reason to watch tonight.
Well, so what are some of the other rumors? I know Minnesota Timberwolves Kevin Garnett has been
Well, that's the big one. Sean Marion is being rumored as going somewhere else. Lamar Odom, possibly. Jermaine O'Neal. There are all kinds of names out there, but none of it means a whole heck of a lot till somebody can come make a deal.
Okay. But if they do, you heard it here.
Or some gibberish applying to it. I don't know.
Wimbledon, it stopped raining long enough to get some tennis in. Top seed Roger Federer advanced, expected. How many straight wins?
50 straight wins, 50 straight matches on grass. So there's really no reason to assume that he will lose unless it rains hard enough so they actually play underwater and then there's somebody who's good at that.
Or injures him. And in football, after congressional hearings this week with former players, union reps, the National Football League officials, some lawmakers say they're going to take action if the league doesn't improve its player disability plan. Now, the complaint from players is that the industry generates about $7 billion a year, but they've paid out only $63,000 apiece to 317 retirees that have debilitating injuries, broken bones, knees, backs, concussions sustained from playing days. Is this for real? Is Congress really going to do something, or are they hoping that the NFL will?
The strategy of taking this to Congress leaves me a little puzzled. How good a job has the U.S. Congress done addressing the health care needs of poor and damaged people who didn't happen to play in the National Football League? Our health care system is a disgrace. So the idea that Congress should be responsible for taking care of these tiny little subset of injured, damaged people strikes me as a little bizarre. The money for taking care of these folks should come out of the pockets of the owners and the people who have been making millions and millions and millions of dollars off the television show that is the National Football League.
But you're saying Congress should perhaps look at national health care?
Of course
they
should.
But can they push the NFL to do this?
Well, Congress is pretty good at pushing. I mean, they pushed baseball into testing for steroids, which baseball, of course, didn't want to do. And they have FaceTime. They can get up in front of cameras and make noise, and perhaps something will happen.
Speaking of testing for steroids, we only have a few seconds, but but we know there was a loss in the world of world wrestling entertainment. The chair, Vince McMahon, said that steroids did not play a role in the murder-suicide of Chris Benoit, but the wrestler who killed his wife and his son and then himself. But others are saying what? More inspection of steroid use in
Well, Mr. McMahon is saying simultaneously steroids played no role and we won't know anything until the toxicology reports are in. So I'm not sure how seriously we can take that. Steroids are so prevalent in that world that it's hard to imagine they weren't somehow involved.
Mm. Bill Littlefield, sports and much more. NPR's Only a Game. Thanks.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Have you ever made a memory box? A few pressed flowers, pictures of grandma, seashells from a long-ago vacation. It's a tradition that goes back to the Victorian era, but you may also have been influenced by 20th century American artist Joseph Cornell. Today we're going to hear some of the music Cornell listened to as he created these tiny universes out of ordinary objects, photo scraps, marbles, feathers, sand, set into boxes, adding springs and drawers till they became like games in an arcade. Joseph Cornell became a pioneer in the art of assemblage. He was friend to Andy Warhol, Robert Rauschenberg, and others, but lived unassumingly with his mother and brother in Queens, New York. He called himself a maker, and we're going to talk about how he made his work with Linda Hartigan, chief curator at the Peabody Essex Museum here in Massachusetts, where the exhibit Joseph Cornell Navigating the Imagination is on view. Welcome, Linda.
I'm glad to be here.
We also have Skip Batchelor on the line. He's the grandnephew of Joseph Cornell. Skip, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here as well.
I'm looking at some of these boxes. I also have one of Linda's books on Joseph Cornell. She has another one coming out in the fall, and I'm looking at these beautiful boxes with, you know, cut-out parrots, many of them three-dimensional, so parrots and other birds, doves, eggs in a white box, just so beautiful and simple. When you were growing up, did you see these works?
Yes. We would visit the house in Flushing when I was very young, and the house was filled with boxes and in the workshop. These are things that we really lived with as far back as I can remember.
I'm looking, again, Linda, in your book, there's one box that's a beautiful old map and silver rings and a hanging in front of it with a glass with a blue ball. How do you describe this? And by the way, listeners can go to our website, here-now.org. We'll have a lot of the images there. But how would you describe them?
It's interesting to me that you keep using the word beautiful, yeah. Because they do have this incredibly sophisticated sense of someone carefully and lovingly assembling these elements so that they're staging vignettes that make you wonder about what's going on and that you can begin to tell your own story or create your own journey. But he was very much influenced by the notion of miniature theaters and shadow boxes and using that as a way of framing a lot of his interests, because this man was incredibly erudite and sophisticated.
Well, in fact, I'm looking at the piece. It's untitled, then, Blue Sand Tray with Starfish. You know, it's funny. I have a table at home that's a glass cover over a tray.
Uh-huh.
And I've also tried to do this. It's white sand with a couple of starfish, only he's thrown the sand or placed it so that there's a revealed blue that looks like the Milky Way. His looks like art, mine doesn't. You know, why is that art? What are we seeing there?
Well, I think especially in terms of the sandboxes, he's created these slices of sea still lifes, if you will. If you just think of yourself looking down at a rectangle of sand and the whole notion of sand flowing like the sands of time. But he's compartmentalizing ideas and images in a way to project us out into the world of imagination. It's just not about his imagination. He was an artist who believed in making art to really stimulate our own creativity and our wonder in the world.
In one of your lectures at the Peabody Essex Museum, you play some of the music that he listened to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all this fantastic, you know, Debussy and Tchaikovsky and, you know, music boxes. Skip, when you were growing up and you were visiting him at his house, was this music playing? Did it feel like being inside this kind of a music box when you were there?
He always played music when he was working in the studio in the basement. But the whole house, each box is almost like the tip of this large iceberg. Mm. It has this whole vast array of information and reference associated with it, and the house is filled with things. Books have notations in them, record album covers in their bags, propped all around the house because they have notes on them. constantly thinking, ruminating over many different things. And so music was vitally important in connection with all else. And he also had a very wide-ranging taste in music. It wasn't just specifically ballet, for instance. He was interested in early modern American music and pop music and things, really all things of all culture.
Well, you mentioned ballet. We understand the man you called Uncle Joe was transfixed by the Russian ballerina Tamara Tumanova.
Yes, and others as well, and the ballet in general.
Linda, how would he take that fixation and put it in a box?
Well, frequently what he did was to collect material, photographs, bits of costume, writings about the particular ballerina, and then encapsulate that sort of thing in his box constructions. He often talked about doing what he called unauthorized biographies, this whole notion of capturing the fleeting. He was very concerned about how someone like Tumanova would dance. It might linger in your memory, but he wanted to create something that was lasting, because performance and the life of a performer ultimately are very ephemeral.
Well, Skip, your great uncle lived with his mom in Flushing, in that home you visited, until she died. He also lost his brother Robert, who had cerebral palsy. So he was somewhat alone at the end, and people think of him as a recluse, you know, surrounded by these boxes. Is that a sadness? Is there sadness there? Or?
No, I don't believe so. And actually, I think recluse is a misconception. Mm-hmm. He was reluctant, let's just say, or reticent about presenting himself to the art world when he had a show or a gallery. He didn't like all that sort of social aspect. He did not go to many of his openings, if any, I think. And so that perhaps started this sort of myth. But he actually had many correspondences with many different people and on a regular basis.
I just want to leave with, you know, what may be your favorite, some of your favorite boxes. Mine is the Dovecotes.
Uh-huh.
These are the white boxes that were separated into these little compartments. So it's all white painted wood, small compartments, and into each one he's put one white egg. Did he ever say anything to you, Skip, about what those were?
He would actually be more interested in what we would think about them.
Right.
And without judgment. He was open. One of the most open persons I've ever met, actually, open to experience and not just what one might consider a tasteful experience. I remember one time when we were young watching television, and it was the world wrestling, you know, the pro wrestling, which is goofy stuff. He was completely drawn into it and fascinated by it. So he had a wide-ranging interest. He was interested in all things. I don't know how else to put it.
He was of the world and putting pieces of it into boxes at the same time.
Yeah. The common day experience, the mundane, things that most people would just not even notice or dismiss, fascinated him.
And by the way, Skip, you mentioned how, you know, much your great uncle sort of was of the world, kept up with popular culture and music. Mm-hmm. And one of the pieces of music that he listened to at the time it was big was Catch a Falling Star. We'll leave our listeners with that. He caught them in his boxes. Skip, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Linda, thanks to you as well.
Oh, thanks so much.
Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Save it for a rainy day.
That's Linda Hartigan, curator of Joseph Cornell, Navigating the Imagination, currently on view at the Peabody Essex Museum here in Salem, Massachusetts. Skip Batchelor, grandnephew of artist Joseph Cornell. Information on the music, some images from the show at our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Save it for a rainy day. For when your troubles start multiplying, and they just might, it's easy to forget them without trying. With just a pocket full of starlight, catch a falling star and put it in your pocket.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.